Good afternoon, all of you. Some of you I know, some of you I've yet to meet. Because I have the same last name as your pastor, he's a smarter one, but I'm the older one, okay? Some people like to know a little bit about a speaker before they invest their time in listening to him. So I thought I'd take just a moment to tell you about myself. Our mother was an avid listener to religious radio programs. Back, I won't tell you how far back. You won't believe it. And she came across the church's radio program. We had a huge audience in a radio program around the world in those days. And they published a magazine. You old-timers remember it. It's called The Plain Truth. One day she handed it to me, and my life has never been the same since. Now, my mother never became a member of the Church of God. I did at age 19, and then I attended the Church's College in Pasadena, California. There I met my wife of now 48 years. She grew up in the church when she was 5 years old. Her parents were baptized in the state of Pennsylvania. We have two daughters, one age 32 and the other 26, and so far two grandchildren. Now, after graduation, we lived in Pasadena another 30 years. I was a small business owner, and later we relocated to Columbus, Ohio. Now, I'm told I better get this set up before I go further. Kelly will solve all the problems. We don't worry about it. But I might say that 30 years ago today, during the days of unleavened bread, no less, the United Church of God formed. And the reason the United Church of God formed, for those of you who may not have been around, is in the former church that we attended, there were a small group of men, very small, and they gained full legal authority of the church. And without a vote, without any consultation, they forcefully changed major teachings of that church, teachings that that church had held for more than 60 years. Now, the essence of the change as it applies to us is that these small group of men asserted that an observance of holy days, like the days of unleavened bread, or a Sabbath day, are no longer the will of God for Christians. They were meant only for Jews when Moses led the children of Israel out of Egypt. Only for Jews, not for Christians. Now, because our former church was a well-known Sabbath-keeping church, news of this change shocked them, and they also felt under attack. And when these denominations saw they were under attack, some people took action. In response, one medical doctor in Southern California, member of the United Church of God, organized what was called a Sabbath conference. And he invited all these other Sabbath-keeping denominations to send speakers to the Sabbath conference. And they did. Dennis Luker represented the United Church of God, newly formed. Now, the keynote speaker at the conference was a Seventh-day Adventist scholar by the name of Dr. Samuel Bakayoki. Some of you old-timers might remember that name. He was a charismatic individual, and when he tells his story, he says he was born in Rome, about a stone's throw away from the Vatican. And his mother and father were reading the Bible one day, and they discovered a Sabbath day in the Bible. They could find no other day. And so on their own, they began observing a seventh-day Sabbath. Well, young Samuel was not a happy camper because his parents then forbade him to go out and play soccer with the other boys. And later on, the family moved to the United States, discovered the Seventh-day Adventist Church, and became members of it. But young Samuel always had a burning question in his mind. Why do all the Christian community observe and embrace a Sunday when the Bible talks about a Sabbath day? And when he became of age, he went back to Italy, spoke perfect native Italian because that's how he grew up, and entered a prestigious university, a Catholic university by the name of the Gregorian, so I can get the name of it right, Pontifical Gregorian University. And he pursued a doctoral dissertation on the subject, why did the Christian church in the first century move from Sabbath keeping to later embracing Sunday? He did very well academically, with the highest distinction in graduation, received a gold medal from Pope John Paul VI. And later he turned his dissertation into a book titled From Sabbath to Sunday. Some of you may have that book. Because of his scholarly background, he was a keynote speaker at this Sabbath conference in Southern California. Now, there were 500 individuals there at that conference. Another man was also invited to speak. He used to be an instructor at Ambassador College. He became a true scholar, and later in life he became a prolific author. In fact, the founder of our old church called him one of our very best teachers. But he got crossways with the founder later on, and I hadn't seen him in 22 years. And when I saw him at the conference, I went up and I introduced myself to him as one of his former students. First thing out of his mouth, "Understand," he said, "that I no longer live my life according to Moses." Oh, I instantly knew what he meant. We were, after all, at a Sabbath conference, and everybody in that room, all 500, were observed a seventh-day Sabbath except him. And he wanted me to know that up front. Of course, I already knew that. I've been tracking his career. But then he said something very surprising. "But," he said, he spent 14 years in the old church, "but I don't regret any of the years I spent in the WCG. Now, I was surprised at that, and I asked him why. And his answer surprised me. I want you to listen to his answer, because that'll form the basis of the rest of the message today. Why didn't he regret any of the years he spent in the old church? Here's his answer. "Because by observing those days, I learned things that I never could have learned from a book." Because by observing those, he meant, you know, days of unleavened bread, "I learned things that I never could have learned from a book." This is a remarkable admission from him, a man who spent his entire life reading books and writing books. "By observing those days, I learned things that I never could have learned from a book." I'm going to make a similar assertion today, that those of you who have been observing the days of unleavened bread for any length of time, I believe that you see things in the Bible that other people simply cannot see. They don't have a clue even exists. So the title I have for the message today is The Hidden Days. The Hidden Days of Unleavened Bread in the Bible. And what we're going to find, that the days of unleavened bread are mentioned in the Bible before Moses was ever born. Now, I cannot prove that the events we're going to discuss today happened during the days of unleavened bread. I cannot prove that. But there are clues and there are hints. And because you have observed the days of unleavened bread, when you see these hints and clues, you're able to recognize these hints in the Bible. Finally, in the interest of full disclosure today, some of the observations I'm going to discuss did not originate with me. They originated with other Church of God speakers through the years, and I'm simply borrowing some of them. First book I'd like you to look at, please, would be Genesis chapter 1 and verse 14. I'm going to put it on the screen for you, make it a little easier for you today. But it's in Genesis 1, verse 14. I'm going to put a couple of verses up today. I'm going to use a New International Version because I like its clarity and simplicity. Genesis 1 and verse 14. And God said, let there be lights in the vault of the sky to separate the day from the night, and let them serve as signs to mark sacred times. Did I get? Yes. New International Version. Let them serve as signs to mark sacred times. NIV isn't alone. We'll look at the Christian Holman Standard Bible. Same verse. Then God said, let there be lights in the expanse of the sky to separate the day from the night. They will serve as signs for festivals. So as the earth is being created, Genesis tells us that God put lights in the sky, separate the day. That wasn't the only purpose. God put lights in the sign for a secondary reason, to mark sacred times or to serve as signs for festivals. And the King James translators missed this second element entirely. Put a Hebrew word up for you today. Promise there won't be a test. It's only going to be one word. It's moedim. The meaning in English is, you know this, appointed times. That's all you need to remember. It's appointed times. Now, you understand this. You contact the dentist's office and you make an appointment. Well, the dentist is committed to that appointment time, isn't he? You're committed to the appointment. What if you don't show up? Dentist is still there. Appointment's still on the books. You just didn't show up. Well, God has appointed times. And if humans don't show up, God still shows up at the appointed time. Now, I'm going to go through two examples today. They're actually ones you already know, but you might not have seen them in this light. Jesus was crucified at an appointed time, at the Passover. Wasn't a week early, wasn't a week late. In fact, the New Testament tells us that Jesus died, remember the time? At the ninth hour. That would be hour 3 o'clock in the afternoon. At the ninth. If you were a 12-year-old boy and you looked up at the foot of the where he's being crucified and you saw him breathe his last, and you ran over not too far away to the temple, what would you see? If you wormed your way through the other people, you would see the high priest, the official high priest, taking the official lamb, slitting the lamb's throat, catching the blood in a basin, exactly at the right time. Same time. If you were the Father in heaven, you looked down, you saw Jesus breathe his last and die at the same time the high priest slit the lamb's throat. Jesus died at an appointed time. Now, this suggests that God did not invent Passover with Israel coming out of Egypt. Because the Passover was already one of God's appointed times at the earth's creation. Now look at another memory verse for you just to buttress this point. Found in Revelation 13 and verse 8. I'll put it on the screen. We know that Jesus is called the Lamb of God. And this passage tells us that the Lamb was slain from when? From the foundation of the world. From the very beginning, there was an appointed time for Jesus to die. You also know the second example, Acts chapter 2 and verse 1. I'll put it on the screen. Acts 2 and verse 1. This is God sending the Holy Spirit. When did God choose to send the Holy Spirit down to earth to be available to all mankind? Well, it was on the day of Pentecost. Not a day early, not a day late. Typically, it says when the day of Pentecost had fully come. Now, the new leaders of the former church that we had taught that these days were only for Jews, only for their observation, not for Christians. But the birth of the Christian church and the giving of the Holy Spirit occurred exactly on a Jewish holy day. So if the intent of God was to separate Jewish day observance from Christian observance, he sure muddied the water, didn't he? No. Pentecost was one of God's appointed times. Now, with this as background, we're going to look at some other passages today. But keep this in mind, what we've just covered. First one is in Genesis chapter 18, Genesis 18 and verse 6. Let me give you the background to this first. Abraham is sitting out under a shade tree. It's really hot in the Middle East. You know this story. Three men is off in a distance. Hospitality is a really big deal in the Middle East. He goes running out to see them. Two of them are angels. The other one we know as God in a man's body. Okay? Now, let me clear up something right at first. So nobody gets concerned. Jesus said very plainly in the New Testament, no man has seen the Father at any time. So this wasn't the Father coming down. This was the one who became Christ Jesus later. Okay. Abraham sees him, runs back to the tent apparently. So Abraham hurried into the tent to Sarah. Quick, he said, get three asiyahs of the finest flour and knead it and bake some bread. Did you catch anything? Somebody's going to be baking bread. What kind of bread do you think Sarah is going to make? Well, the odds are it was unleavened bread because they were in a hurry. There's no time to wait around for hours and hours and let bread rise, is it there? Now, this means nothing except for what comes later in the story. And we'll get to that shortly. One reason God came down to the earth at that time is because he's been getting reports up in heaven. Presumably the angels are sending reports about the exceeding evil nature of the men in the city of Sodom and Gomorrah. So we come to Genesis 18 now in verse 20. Here's what God says. The outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is so great and their sins so grievous that I will go down and see if what they have done is as bad as the outcry that has reached me. If not, I will know. Now the picture one gets is that the angels are sending up reports to God, and we know from the story that God later decides to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. Well, God is in heaven. Why did he just dial in the coordinates of the city, send an asteroid down, or take it out? Well, before he destroys the city, he says he wants to personally go down and verify the evil. He's not taking the angel's word for it. I actually like that characteristic about God. But first, he visits Abraham in a man's body. It implied is that he's going to walk about the city of Sodom later, maybe even in a man's body, to get a first-hand sense of their actions and attitudes and the hatred that exists in the city. Then the story tells us that the two angels leave Abraham and God and go down to the city of Sodom. So they're standing Abraham and God. And then the text tells us that God has a thought. He says, should I hide from Abraham what I'm about to do? He's thinking about the destruction of Sodom. And then he says another thing. I'm sorry. And then we learn a reason why God is thinking about telling Abraham what he's going to do. It's a fascinating reason. God is represented as thinking out loud. And he says two things. Abraham is going to become a great nation. And I know that he will teach his children. What does this have anything to do with the story? Well, the context makes God's thinking clear. If Abraham has lots of children, be a great nation, and he teaches his children, he'll tell them what I'm doing, what I've done in the city of Sodom. Otherwise, the people on the earth will watch just a weird, random event. Sodom got blasted, and we have no idea why. But if God tells Abraham, and Abraham teaches his children, and they become a great nation, then the lesson of Sodom and Gomorrah is going to last for all of mankind. Eventually, the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, I believe, has reached at least a billion people on the earth. You know, I can't imagine there's ever a day, even in the United States, where somebody doesn't say Sodom and Gomorrah. Everybody has an allusion to what that story means. And if that's true, then God's idea to tell Abraham first worked, didn't it? So then the story has the two angels going on down to Sodom. There's Lot sitting at the gate, sees the two angels. I don't think he knew of their angels at this point, but I don't know. Runs out to greet them. Again, hospitality is a really big deal in the Middle East. And he invites them to stay in his house for the evening. I don't know, but I suspect Lot knows what else goes on in the city at night. And the angels tell him no. Tell him no. Lot's persistent. And so eventually they acquiesce to Lot. I actually like this part of the story. Angels that don't appear to be robots. They have freedom to interact. They didn't know Lot's going to invite them into his house. So they do. Now we come to an important verse that I really do want you to pay attention to. It's Genesis chapter 19, Genesis 19 and verse 3. This is a good one. And what's Lot do? Then he made them a feast and baked unleavened bread. And they ate. Why in the world are the words feast and unleavened bread included in the text? Can't the story of Sodom and Gomorrah be told without mentioning, oh, by the way, Lot made them unleavened bread for supper? What does that have to do with the story? What does it add? You have to realize that Moses is writing this 400 years later. He's leaving a legacy for Israel. Most of the Israelites, completely illiterate. Not bad people, just illiterate. Pharaoh, and Moses raised in Pharaoh's court. He knows how to read and write. He's not going to be around. He's leaving a memory in a book of who they are and the gift that God has through Abraham for that land so they don't back out a second time. And he's writing down all the details of their history. Now, Moses knows that later they're going to be observing the days of unleavened bread. They didn't observe them in the desert. They got manna, okay? Do you think when he wrote down in the text this incident about Lot serving unleavened bread, it's going to click in the Israelites' mind? I think it did. That's why he anticipates it and writes it in the story. But now there's a problem. Moses lived 400 years after Abraham. How did Moses know that Lot gave unleavened bread to the angels? We have to remember something. Moses had an advantage that you and I don't have. Because for 40 years, he got to speak with God. The text says, face to face, as a man does his friend. So Moses was in a position to write down and receive from God every detail of the story of Sodom and Gomorrah. Again, the mention of the words unleavened bread doesn't prove anything, but it is a hint, isn't it? It's a strong hint, and it fits within the larger context of the story. So now we got the angels inside of Lot's house. And you're familiar with the story. That night, all the men of the city, text says all, also says from the youngest to the oldest. Another strange thought. Lot, I believe, knows what they have in mind because they've told him. Send him out, we want to abuse them. Lot comes out, tries to calm down the mob, right? Don't do so wickedly, he said. What's going on here? Some years ago, I was in Israel. I mean, an excellent Israeli tour guide. He brought up the subject. He begins to go through the story, and he sees that we have younger people than he wants in the audience, and he stops. He says, come and see me privately if you want to. So I saw him privately, and I said, I'd like you to finish your story. And he says, do you remember in the book of Judges, there was a Levite, and he had a concubine. and they were going through the tribal territory of Benjamin. And as they go through, one of the Benjamite men says, come and stay at my house tonight. And so the Levite and his concubine do. And then the story tells us a very similar thing happened. Hoodlums, right, surrounded the house, presumably beat on the door, and demanded they send the man out that we might abuse him. And then he said, here's what's going on. If you go through the territory of Benjamin, he didn't say this, but it's the same concept. If you go to Boston or Chicago, you got to pay a toll on the highway, don't you? What do you think the toll was back here? You got to pay a toll by giving one of yours to abuse. That's what was going on. Same thing back in a city of Lot. Now, all the men of the city wanted to abuse the two men. They have no idea they're angels, of course. And if the two men happen to die in the process, then they're my, well, that's just entertainment. No Netflix streaming in those days. From the youngest to the oldest. Now, if this turns your stomach, well, it probably did to the angels as well. And so they've been sending up reports to God about the evil done in the city. Why did God come down when he did? If he's been getting reports months, years, why did he wait to come down at this point? Well, the hint in the story is that he chose to come down at an appointed time. What appointed time? Well, I believe it was the days of unleavened bread. Because just as you remove leavening from your homes prior as a type of sin, God removes extreme sin from the earth. Why? Because if you let it spread, Paul says, what happens? A little leaven leavens the entire lump. It appears that God wanted this contamination off of the earth before it spread further. Now, allow me a little space for some speculation as to why. This isn't in the account in Genesis, not that long after the Noahian flood. Remember what God said when he saw everything? There was violence in the earth in those days. It repents me that I made man on the earth. And the implication is, if I had to do it all over again, I wouldn't do it. It's more merciful for me to take these people out, bring them up in another resurrection, than to have them raise children in this environment. And now what's happening in the city of Sodom and Gomorrah? Presumably, a violence that is of a similar nature. God isn't ready for that to happen on the earth today. Sodom is a rich city on a trading route. Got rich, okay? And when trading routes, it's where the news and information spread, it practices to. If God let it go on, it's at risk of leavening the entire earth. That's Steve's speculation. So what does he do? Comes down and removes it from the earth. The hint? It was during the days of unleavened bread. Now, about a year and a half ago, my wife and I had the opportunity to be in the country of Jordan. And there was a site of what is a modern site, not of what is believed to be the best evidence for being the biblical site of ancient Sodom. Here's what it looks like today. Just ruins. That wouldn't have been too helpful for us, except on our tour bus, there was a church member. And he worked there for two or three summers on the archaeological site itself. And so he was there to give us a tour. I'm really glad he was. Three things he mentioned I thought bore interest. They found skeletal remains. Only, though, the lower half of the body. All of them had, as if it were chopped off, halfway up. So only had remaining the bottom half. Number two, the soil around the city of Sodom was filled with salt. How did salt get way up there? Interesting concept. It's only a mile or two, or at least under 5 miles away, is the Dead Sea, also in the Bible as the Salt Sea. The water comes down from Jordan in the north. By the time it gets down to the Dead Sea, it's the lowest spot on the face of the earth. No way to water get out. So it stays there. The hot Middle Eastern sun comes down and bakes the water, as it were, boils it off, not boil it off, but evaporates it off. And so it leaves the minerals. You put your finger in it, taste it, it's full of salt. So salty, you go out there, you cannot sink. You can sit down. People do this for fun. They take a newspaper, a book with them, sit down, feet in the air, hands in the air, and they're just sitting there reading a book. You cannot sink. That's how thick it is. One of the teachers I had mentioned something about the Jewish historian Josephus, first century Jewish historian. And Josephus tells a story of two escaped Roman prisoners, Roman soldiers coming after them on horses. Two prisoners get to the edge of the Dead Sea, jump into the water, start swimming. The Roman soldiers sit down and say, oh, wait. Okay. It's 11 miles to Jordan on the other side. They'll get tired. They just keep on going. Can't sink. They escaped. Now, here's some speculation. Let me show you this first. By the way, here's the... I missed this picture. This is our church member giving us a tour of the area. Now, in Russia, in the eastern part, in Siberia, in 1908, there was an asteroid that came down. Here's what it would look like. Here's another asteroid that came down about 10 years ago. And what was significant is that, well, you know, when you have an American spacecraft come down from outer space, there's a vacuum up there. You hit the atmosphere of the Earth. You got molecules of air. And it hits that spacecraft. It's going to burn up unless you put a heat shield in front of it. Well, an asteroid has no heat shield, so it's heating up with all that air molecule slamming into it, heats into a big ball, and then has a type of nuclear explosion. No crater in Siberia, didn't hit it. Above the forest, some miles, it exploded. Shockwaves come down and blasts millions of trees. And this is the speculation of what happened in the city of Sodom. Asteroid comes by at a very shallow angle, high rate of speed, heats up, doesn't hit the Dead Sea, but has a type of atomic explosion on all the heat above the Dead Sea. The force, the shock force, comes down in the Dead Sea. What does it do? Splashes that water up around the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, like a boy in a bathtub, right? Boys have done this. Bathtub water's full, and they slam their head, and then the walls... full of water, isn't it? Okay. Number three, they found a substance around the city of Sodom in the soil. They took it to Los Alamos, New Mexico, where the U.S. invented the first atomic bomb, and it turned out to be a substance called trinitite. And the lab asked them, where did you get this? It's trinitite. They told them. But trinitite, you see, is a glass layer that you get when you set off an atomic bomb in the desert and it melts the sand. Here it was, right in the same area as Sodom and Gomorrah. What appears to have happened is that God came down, I believe at an appointed time, during the days of unleavened bread, and he cauterized those two cities off the face of the earth with a type of nuclear explosion. Now, there's another small hint in the Old Testament. This one we tend to read right over. Found in Exodus chapter 5 and verse 1. This is what Moses is supposed to go in and tell Pharaoh. I'll put it on the screen. This is what the Lord says, the God of Israel says. Let my people go that they may hold a festival to me in the wilderness. What festival? Days of unleavened bread are mentioned until the book of Leviticus. But the days of unleavened bread are an appointed time at the creation of the earth to mark sacred times and as signs for festivals. The implication was, even though Pharaoh didn't know it and the Israelites didn't know it, the festival God had in mind was consistent with that of the days of unleavened bread. Now we'll leave the Old Testament and move to the New Testament. Another story that you're familiar with. Jesus comes into the city of Jerusalem around a few days before Passover. Right? Visits the temple. What's he find? Well, in a courtyard of the temple, he found the selling of cattle and sheep and doves. What else did he find? Sitting at the tables were men exchanging money. What's going on? Well, we get a clue in the book of Acts. Because in the book of Acts, it says 17 men from 17 different nations arrived, speaking 17 different languages. They have their own currency. They're going to come to Jerusalem in observance of one of the festival days. Got to buy some cattle. Use a sacrifice. They don't want your money. You first have to sit at the table and exchange your money for the local currency and pay the local farmer, whatever it is that owns the animals. Okay? You got stacks of money on the table, long lines. Some of the commentaries say 400,000 people fled into that little city on the festival. It's a booming business time. So this part of the temple has been turned into a stockyards. Now, I grew up on a dairy farm. I've been in numerous stockyards. Some of you have. Where you have cattle, what else you have? You have manure on the floor. You have open-toed sandals. People are stepping in it. What else you have? Well, manure puts out an odor, doesn't it? Who's attracted to that? Flies are, by the hundreds and thousands, coming to find a perfect place to lay their eggs. And you have the sound of cattle mooing and of sheep bleating. What does Jesus do when he sees all of this? Text says he made a whip. Now, for those who haven't had cattle experience, these kind of cattle which are around human beings become tame. They're not frightened of humans. We had some wild ones that we raised in the woods, not a pasture. You couldn't get near them. Totally wild and skittish. But if they grow up with humans touching them, bringing them food, they can be as tame as can be. I remember one incident in a dairy barn. We had a cow, several cows you could do this with. I would come up to it, laying down, chewing its cud, the most peaceful scene you can imagine. I touch its back, it's laying down. Oh, it knows something's there. Moves its ear back. The eyes are on the side, see? Just move its ear back, turn its head a little bit. Now I can see, is there a danger or not? No danger, chewing the cud. I climb onto the back, lay down, 5 minutes, animal's not concerned. Animal like that is tame, all right? Until a trucker comes when you have to buy or sell some cattle. Backs his big truck up to the door, gets on a ramp, wants a cow to walk up, got some big boards on the side, can't jump off. Cow doesn't want to go up in this strange thing, sniffing all over the place. Trucker has no patience. A 10-year-old boy learns all kinds of vocabulary he shouldn't probably know at that point. Brings out his cane and a lot of yelling, smacking on that rear end of that cow, trying to get it up. Finally, the fear in the cow becomes greater than the fear of going up the ramp, and it goes up the ramp. Let me go get the next animal, take up the ramp. In the temple area, I'm assuming these cattle have a rope around them. They're tame, used to being led. How are you going to get them to move? It says Jesus made a whip, and he drove the sheep and the cattle out. It doesn't say it. My own experience says not only do you have to have a whip, you have to have an awfully loud voice. Okay? What else did he do? Overturn the money changer's table. Coins rolling everywhere, plopping down into the manure. Now, I wasn't there. I have to use my imagination. You get thousands of dollars worth of coins there. It's a great business opportunity. But the money changers implied fled, assuming they even abandoned them. Doesn't say that, but it's an assumption. I'll get to that in just a minute. Let's look at Mark chapter 11. And verse 16. I'll put it on the screen. Mark 11 and verse 16. After they were out, it says, Jesus would not allow anyone to carry merchandise through the temple courts. I wasn't there. Here's my picture I get in my mind. They see a man with a whip in his hand, having chased cattle out with a loud voice. Money changers fleeing and leaving their money inside. He has an angry look on his face, or at least a determined look on his face. And he's not, you got merchandise, you're not coming in. Now forgive me at this point, ladies, allow me to do some what we call mansplaining, okay? All the men in here know this, but I have to go through it anyway. A boy in first grade quickly learns in the schoolyard, playground yard, something brand new. There are bigger boys. There are stronger boys. Some of them, I mean, even bullies. Some of them are going to come up and approach you. And you quickly learn as a boy, can I take him or can he take me? Okay? There's a famous Canadian psychologist, some of you know by the name of Jordan Peterson, talks about this. He says, when two men are having an argument or a heated discussion, just beneath the surface, they both know if it gets too heated, one can take a swipe at the other one. I'm going to guess it goes on until the men reach about 45, maybe 50 before they think that's stupid. But up until then, they know it's there. Right? So I'm guessing that these people who were looking at Jesus saw a man standing there who meant business with a whip in his hand. They already calculated it wasn't worth it to rush him. Okay? Not going to. Text implies that nobody got past Jesus with his merchandise. What do you think's going on with this account? You remember when this occurred? A couple days before Passover. What were the Jews doing a couple days before Passover? Well, they were doing what you did. They were removing leavening from their private houses, weren't they? Leavening is a type of sin. Jesus called the temple what? His Father's house. Right? Jesus was removing sin from his Father's house. At the same time, Jews are removing leavening from their private houses. Mark 11, verse 17. Is it not written, my house should be called a house of prayer? But you have made it a den of thieves for all nations. Again, right before the days of unleavened bread. And finally, we'll look at Book of Corinthians. 1 Corinthians chapter 5. Long-time members know this passage. It gets typically gone through once every year at the Holy Days. Now, scholars agree on one thing about the first letter of 1 Corinthians. It was either written during the days of unleavened bread, okay, or written a couple weeks before so that it got to the Corinthian church during the days of unleavened bread. They don't keep the days of unleavened bread, scholars don't, but they can see evidence in here that this is so, and so will you as soon as we talk about it. The reason they believe that is because of some wording that Paul uses in the text. Let me put it on the screen. Here's the word Paul uses in English. Here's the word lump, as in a lump of dough. He uses the phrase, you are puffed up like a loaf of bread. He tells them to put out the old leavening. He tells them to become unleavened. He tells them to become a new lump. And finally he says, therefore let us keep the feast. Here you are, 2,000 years later, and you know what these terms mean, because you have been observing the days of unleavened bread. You understand what he's talking about. You know who else understood these terms? The Corinthian church, a predominantly Gentile church. A Gentile church understood these things because they were observing the days of unleavened bread 25 years after Jesus had died. Now, the specific problem that Paul is addressing is that there's a man in the church who's been sleeping with his father's wife. You're familiar with the story. That's problem number one. Second problem, the sin was no longer private. All of the church knew about it. Problem number three, it's even worse. When they knew about it, they weren't sorrowful, sad, mourning. They were glorying about it, the exact opposite. Paul was appalled at their glory. Let me try a modern analogy for you to see if we can put ourselves in Paul's shoes. Let's say a man in the church wants to earn some extra income. Going to have a part-time job. We're in a library, aren't we? Sees a sign in a library somewhere. And it says part-time job, and he goes and inquires what it's about. They want the individual to dress up in a drag costume, put on a dance performance for kindergartners in the library. This happens in America this past couple of years. Okay? Now, the whole church, let's suppose he takes it. The whole church knows about it, and they laugh about it, chuckling about it. No big deal, right? You think that attitude would affect people in our church? Paul seems to think so, right? A little leaven, he wrote, leavens the whole lump. And because it now affected all of the Corinthian church, Paul was forced to deal with it publicly. 1 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 6. Your glorying, he wrote, is not good. Don't you know that a little leaven leavens the whole lump? You let this sin continue, you're at risk of ruining the entire church in the city of Corinth. What do you do about it? Verse 7. Therefore, purge out the old leaven that you may be a new lump. They had to tell the man. You know, Paul wasn't there. He wrote it by letter. This would be awkward. When you're all together, man's probably sitting there as well. What do you have to do? They had to tell him, we love you, but you cannot fellowship with us while you're sleeping with your father's wife. In Paul's mind, this sin, now publicly known, had to be removed just like they had removed leavening from their private houses. Paul's not happy about having to write this letter. He said, I wrote it with many tears. So after all of this today, what are we to conclude? Well, we've gone over to the allusions to the days of unleavened bread in the Bible, haven't we? What I've called the hidden days of unleavened bread. And we found that at the creation of the earth, God put lights in the sky, not just to separate the day and the night, but to mark sacred times and as signs for festivals. We find that Lot made a feast for the angels by baking unleavened bread. And the text goes out of his way to tell us that it was unleavened bread. And we find it consistent that God would come down to the earth to remove egregious sin of Sodom and Gomorrah during the days of unleavened bread. And we find that Jesus cleared sin out of his father's house at the same time the Jews were removing leavening from their private houses. And lastly, we find the Apostle Paul writing a letter with tears, urging a Gentile church to remove the publicly sinning man so the church could indeed become spiritually unleavened. We might call these the hidden days of unleavened bread in the Bible. And again, because you have been observing the days of unleavened bread, you can see these hints and clues in the Bible when you read them. And finally, we believe the day is coming when all of mankind will be learning the lessons of the days of unleavened bread.